getting these tax credits off our books in a shorter timeline frees up those frozen credit markets. It allows new development to continue.
A bill to issue bonds to pay off oil and gas tax credits passes the House. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the U.S. and Canada are on opposite sides of Anwar drilling.
And the first thing I said was, Ambassador, I'm not sure you understand what your own country's interests are.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside Alaska. And it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 1-800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
The Alaska House passed a bill today that would allow the state government to issue bonds to pay off tax credits to oil and gas companies. The state owes the companies more than $800 million in tax credits. The bill would allow the state to pay the credits off quickly. Anchorage Independent Representative Jason Gren says this will allow more investment for oil exploration and development.
Let's do it in a way that directly addresses the uncertainty, particularly for small and independent oil and gas exploration companies. Getting these tax credits off our books in a shorter timeline frees up those frozen credit markets. It allows new development to continue, and it provides certainty in a time when our economy needs it most.
State payments for the credits slowed as oil prices fell, but companies have said the delayed payments have hurt development. Both industry and labor unions supported the bill. Juneau Democratic Representative Sam Keto III opposed it. He says the state shouldn't commit to paying the tax credits early when state spending exceeds state revenue.
I can't say that we have our fiscal house in order.
The state would receive a discount of roughly 5 to 10 cents on the dollar to cover the cost of issuing the bonds. The vote on the bill was 23 to 15. Most members of the mostly Democratic majority voted against the measure. All but two members of the Republican minority, David Eastman of Wasilla and Mark Newman of Big Lake, voted for it. The bill now heads to the Senate. A legislative ethics committee has dismissed a complaint against an Alaska lawmaker over his aggressive use of the legislature's moving policy. The committee found Democratic Senator Donnie Olson of Golovin did not violate ethics law because the legislative moving policy in effect at the time did not clearly prohibit him from shipping to Juneau in 2015 and 16 items including a washer and dryer, yard tools, air compressors, and a large desk. But the committee found Olson's use of state funds to move such items was contrary to the spirit of the moving policy and resulted in a very strong appearance of impropriety. The policy has since been changed. Olson, who lives in a remote Northwest Alaska community, says he appreciates the committee's decision and will look for future savings. Congress may have voted to open oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, but drilling opponents haven't given up. As part of their strategy going forward, they're looking beyond Washington, D.C. and across U.S.-Canada border for support. But even if Canada is against drilling in the refuge, what could the nation do to stop it? Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
Canada's opposition to oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge comes down to the caribou.
If there is development in this area, and when we do lose the caribou, that will be a significant channel of life that will have dried up and shut down forever.
Dana Tija Tram is a Vuntut Gwich'in council member living in Canada's Yukon Territory. The porcupine caribou herd migrates into Canada and is hunted by his people. Like the Gwich'in in Alaska, he believes any disturbance of the herd's calving grounds in the refuge threatens his community. This is not a new issue. In 1987, the United States signed a treaty with Canada requiring both countries to avoid or minimize activities that would disrupt the caribou. Now, as the Trump administration pursues oil development in the refuge, Tija Tram says the agreement means the U.S. is obligated to consult with Canada before it drills there.
We really have a legitimate voice here. and that belongs in this issue.
Canada's leadership agrees. In an emailed statement, an embassy spokesman said the federal, territorial, and Indigenous governments in Canada are united in their commitment to the conservation of the herd and its habitat. U.S. environmental groups see the treaty as a way to stall the push for oil development in the refuge. Mike Anderson is a lawyer with the Wilderness Society in Seattle.
Certainly the Canadians have made it clear that they expect the treaty to be observed and implemented. You know, this is not what necessarily the Trump administration wants in terms of their rushed timeline.
Anderson says if the U.S. abides by the treaty, it will have to take a careful look at potential impacts on the herd. And that, he hopes, will spur Congress to reconsider whether drilling should be allowed. But Anderson acknowledges the treaty has limits. He says the final decision will be up to the U.S. Yuta Brunet, an international environmental law professor with the University of Toronto, agrees. Brunet says the agreement is legally binding. It requires the U.S. to promptly consult with Canada if the herd is significantly harmed. But, she says,
that's, I think, as far as we can take it. There is no commitment that either side makes that they would stop development.
That said, American supporters of oil development in Anwar are not concerned about Canadian interference. Canadian representatives in Washington, D.C. actively lobbied against the provision in last year's tax bill that opened up the refuge to drilling. So Senator Dan Sullivan says he called the Canadian ambassador for what he referred to as a very frank discussion.
And the first thing I said was, Ambassador, I'm not sure you understand what your own country's interests are.
Sullivan says he told the ambassador to cease and desist the lobbying campaign. In later meetings with Canadian officials, he says he passed along this message.
We're, of course, going to work with Canada, but this kind of action undermines your own country's interests because we're going to remember it.
True to his word, Sullivan says he's preparing to introduce a bill related to the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, a fund that oil producers must pay into, which is used to cover the cost of oil spill cleanups.
And there was always a glitch, always kind of a, in some ways, a loophole that Canadian tar sands that comes across the border into the United States, produced in Alberta, has never had to pay that fee. Well, I think we should close that loophole.
Asked if this was in direct response to Canada's lobbying actions last year, Sullivan responded,
let's just put it, we were thinking about it. We hadn't made a final decision, and their actions certainly help us make the final decision.
Like many proponents of drilling in Anwar, the senator believes the caribou can stay healthy alongside oil development if it's done responsibly. But he doesn't dismiss that the U.S. must uphold its obligations under its 1987 treaty. So Canada may ultimately take its seat at the table. But whether it can convince the U.S. to stop oil development in Anwar is a much taller order. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Alaska Republican gubernatorial contender Scott Hawkins says he has pancreatic cancer but will continue his campaign. A release from Hawkins' campaign today says Hawkins was diagnosed in February and has undergone aggressive treatments while maintaining his schedule. Another Republican, former State Senator Mike Dunleavy, temporarily suspended his campaign last year for medical issues with his heart. In reviving his campaign in December, Dunleavy said his treatments were successful. Governor Bill Walker, an independent, is seeking re-election. Walker announced a prostate cancer diagnosis in late 2016 and had what he described as successful surgery to treat the cancer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the U.S. Energy Secretary pays a visit to a village near Kodiak.
For them to actually come to our community and get to know us and show concern, and it's humbling and it's a great honor.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
An Anchorage man has died after being swept up in an avalanche on Wednesday afternoon. 41-year-old Chad Christman was snow machining on Blackstone Glacier just south of Whittier when the accident occurred. According to a dispatch from the Alaska State Troopers, two men watched as an avalanche covered their friend and his machine. When it stopped, Kreisman was only partially buried. Other people in the area rushed over to help, and the group was able to dig Kreisman out and start CPR. A helicopter from the Alaska Rescue and Coordination Center arrived on scene and transported Kreisman to an Anchorage hospital, but he did not survive the accident. Chad Kreisman's family members have been notified of his death. Senator Lisa Murkowski brought U.S. Energy Secretary Rick Perry to Alaska the last 2 days to visit various parts of the state. While on a day trip to Kodiak to tour the community's electrical grid that's almost entirely powered by renewable energy, Murkowski and Perry hopped on a plane and took a quick detour to the small community of Old Harbor. The community has been working to develop its own renewable resources for decades, but still has a long way to go. KMXT's Mitch Borden has the story.
Rick Burns has been the mayor of Old Harbor for years, and it doesn't seem like that long ago to him when the school had over 100 students. But now?
I think I was told yesterday it was 26. I thought we had 33, but I guess currently we only have 26.
Old Harbor, along with other villages in the Kodiak Archipelago, are having to deal with their populations dropping.
People are migrating out of the villages and looking for jobs and economic stability.
Old Harbor has a plan, according to Burns, to slow its out-migration. The community wants to improve its harbor and start a fish processing plant to develop its economy and keep people in town. There's one problem, though. To entice a company to build a processing plant, the village needs access to cheap and reliable energy. Right now, the community mostly relies on diesel for its power, which can be expensive, and its price often fluctuates. Burns says there is an answer to Old Harbor's energy trouble: hydroelectricity. Since the 1980s, he says the community has been working on a project to generate energy from a local river called Lagoon Creek.
It's a pretty much a run-of-the-river style hydro project, and it has a capacity of maybe 500 kilowatts a generation.
Even though Old Harbor knows how it wants to incorporate hydroelectricity into its electric grid, it still hasn't started construction on the project. That's because it took years and a lot of money, says Burns, for the village to meet all the requirements needed to move forward. And now the community still needs to raise about $11 million to build everything. It was these challenges that inspired Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski to bring Secretary of Energy Rick Perry to Old Harbor. They were on a trip to Kodiak to see its power grid that's almost completely powered by hydro and wind energy. Murkowski brought Secretary Perry to the village so he could better understand the challenges facing some of Alaska's smaller communities.
For him to see how innovation in a place like Kodiak has helped facilitate an economy and see how a smaller area is struggling with an economy but could have the potential to do so much more if they only had a small renewable energy project.
Murkowski would like to see permitting reform that allows smaller hydroelectric projects like Old Harbor's be cleared faster and for less money. Secretary Perry and the Department of Energy doesn't control permitting for hydroelectricity projects. But Murkowski still wanted him to see how places like Kodiak and Old Harbor are being creative in their efforts to reduce energy costs.
My hope is that he goes back to Washington and he's able to say, you ought to see what they're doing in Alaska and how they're doing it. They're taking the lead and they're showing the rest of the country and the rest of the world how to really innovate when it comes to energy.
Rick Burns, Old Harbor's mayor, says Senator Murkowski and Secretary Perry were only able to stay in the village for about an hour. But he says the time the community got with them meant a lot.
For them to actually come to our community and get to know us and show concern, and it's humbling and it's a great honor.
Secretary Perry seemed energized by what he had learned as he left the village, according to Burns. He doesn't expect anything will come from the visit, but he thinks it's valuable that someone in President Trump's administration knows about Old Harbor's situation. After leaving Kodiak, Secretary Perry continued north. The secretary only had 2 days in Alaska and spent the second one in Prudhoe Bay meeting with representatives from the oil and gas industry, according to Senator Murkowski. In Kodiak, I'm Mitch Borden.
Legislation that would change the way the Alaska Marine Highway System runs was introduced last week. House Bill 142 calls for ferry management and operations to be transferred to a publicly owned corporation. Southeast Conference Executive Director Robert Venables worked with legislative staff writing the bill. He says it would take control of the ferry system away from politicians and political appointees.
It provides an executive board that has deep maritime and business expertise into a model of governance that brings labor and management together, working towards common causes and common goals of delivering the best predictable service to the state and the traveling public.
The state-funded ferry system has reduced its fleet and sailings over several years due to budget cuts. The age of the fleet also means frequent interruptions in the schedule. The State Department of Transportation and the Southeast Conference agreed to begin working on the idea about 2 years ago. The legislation is based on studies done for what's called the Alaska Marine Highway Reform Project. Its research includes a review of other ferry systems. It also gathered information from community leaders, passengers, and businesses that use the ferries.
We've been talking a lot of concepts lately, and this is an opportunity now to have it hold the actual statutory language that would create the public corporation.
The bill has been assigned to the House Transportation Committee. Co-chairwoman Louise Stute's office led that work. She was not immediately available for comment. No action is expected this year, so the bill will have to be reintroduced for the next legislative session, but backers expect field hearings before then. Changes in the international recycling business are affecting Alaska communities, but so far, most Southeast cities and businesses haven't had to limit what they collect. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on what's going on.
Before I put out my family's recycling for pickup, I always go through it just to make sure there aren't things in here that won't actually go anywhere other than the dump. I have no problem with some of it. There's a lot of cardboard. There's a couple aluminum soda cans. In they go. But there's also sort of a variety of paper here, colored newspaper ads, junk mail, magazines, and I'm not so sure that'll be recycled. That's because a major overseas buyer of things we'd really like to see reprocessed and reused has cut back on what it's taking in.
In the broader region and across the country, in fact, around the world, there are a lot of changes that are being driven by what China is doing.
Jackie Lang is communications manager for Waste Management. The corporation operates about 150 recycling centers around the nation, including Juneau's. China announced last year that it was limiting the type of recyclables it would buy and raising contamination standards. Beginning January 1st, it stopped taking mixed paper, including newspapers, magazines, and junk mail.
We're having to stockpile and store this material until we can find markets that are able to accept all of it.
Don Tibbetts is general manager of Republic Services in Washington State. His company collects recyclables from Ketchikan, Sitka, and Petersburg, along with more than 60 other U.S. cities. Republic has found new markets in India, Malaysia, and Vietnam, but those nations don't have as much capacity as China.
Unfortunately, paper degrades rather fast and rather quickly in the natural environment. So after some time of being stored, it degrades to a point where it's just no longer marketable.
Tibbetts says about three-quarters of mixed paper is being recycled and the rest is being thrown away. But that's better than expected. When China first announced its new standards, Republic said mixed paper would likely end up in its south-central Washington landfill. China has also cut back on buying some plastics, but Tibbetts says it's not much of a problem.
Plastics are, in relative terms speaking, they're actually a small portion of the recycle stream. So that amount of material, we're still able to move overseas.
China's new rules affect all customers. They've sent recycling wholesalers worldwide searching for new markets, and in some cases, that's driven prices down. That's of concern, especially in the 49th state.
In Southeast Alaska, recycling is a very financially based enterprise.
Carl Hagerman is Petersburg's utility director. He's also been active in a regional organization of cities that barge recycling and garbage south. He says communities sell recyclables to lower that expense.
If the cost to recycle exceeds the cost to ship a solid waste, then it doesn't really pencil out financially, and we may have to look at doing something differently.
Recycling companies do want to see one change. That's less food, liquids, and non-recyclables mixed into the stream. Waste management calls it wish cycling, and it forces the company to throw out an estimated one quarter of what its customers recycle. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Kenai Peninsula's last bowling alley has closed down. Homer Bowlers had their final chance to throw 10 frames on Saturday at Ketchmack Bowl before the building is turned over to Regent Life Church. As KBBI's Renee Gross reports, that's left several bowlers in Homer unsure about what they'll do without the sport.
Richard Everett is playing on one of the few lanes at Ketchmack Bowl that he says works well. He says the other lanes have some quirks.
Those two lanes, you have to manually score it. Those two lanes down there, you got to watch to see if the pins are counted correctly on the far end. You know, things like that. And
Everett has been bowling here for 25 years.
Well, we're going to miss it deeply, and I don't know what I'm going to do with all my bowling balls now. I made a lot of good friends.
Everett competes on the local Special Olympics Unified Team. The team is representing Alaska this summer at the Special Olympics in Seattle. Now that there is no bowling alley left on the peninsula, Everett and his teammates will have to drive the roughly 220 miles to Anchorage to practice. Teammate Robin Darty says she can't afford not to.
So every Saturday from now until the end of June, I'm driving to Anchorage, bowling and driving back, because I need to bowl with that ball to be good enough to compete in Seattle.
Reactions to the alley closing down ranged from disappointment to heartbreak, but most said they saw this coming.
Well, the building is still owned by my mom, and she put it up for sale 2 years ago.
That's Mark Cooper. He owns Ketchmack Bowl, and he leases the space from his mom. He's also the only employee. Cooper says Ketchmack Bowl started in 1959 on Bunnell Street. His family bought it in the 1970s and built the current alley about a decade later. The family was hoping to find someone who would continue operating the bowling alley, but Cooper says that's a tough sell.
Bowling has declined, and that's a nationwide decline. It's become more of a recreational event instead of the league base that used to drive it.
Cooper says he'll miss the variety of people who have walked through the doors over the years, and he adds that he's not quite sure what he'll do next.
It's all I've done for the last 30-some years, so so it's pretty much everybody I know is my customer base.
The Regent Life Church purchased the space Monday and will take it over Tuesday. It plans to make the bowling alley its new location. Reporting in Homer, I'm Renee Gross.
It's official. The Kuskokwim River in front of Bethel has broken. The Kuskokwim Ice Classic tripod sunk through the ice on Wednesday night, stopping the clock. With that, the competition designated three lucky winners to take home thousands of dollars in prize money. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur was on the phone when the winners heard the news.
Hello.
Hi, is this Lily?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Lily. This is my name's Michelle DeWitt, and I'm calling with the Kuskokwim Ice Classic. The annual competition asks people to buy tickets and write down when they think the Bethel ice will break. Whoever guesses closest wins big money. This year, one of those winners is Lily Carter, who lives in Quigilingok and received this call a couple hours after the clock stopped.
It stopped at 7:51 p.m.
Whoa!
I'm curious, is that a familiar time to you?
Yep.
So congratulations, Lily. You're one of the Ice Classic winners.
Whoa!
There is another winner, so you will split the jackpot with one other person.
Hello.
Hey, is this Ben?
This is Ben.
Hey, Ben. Michelle DeWitt here.
Ben Kuntz of Bethel also guessed the ice would break at 7:51 p.m. on May 2nd.
Congratulations, Ben, because you are one of two winners of the 2018 Cusco Ice Classic.
Wow, all right.
Ben and Lily will split the $12,500 jackpot.
Wow, thank you.
We're happy to share it.
Lily plans to use the money to pay her bills. Ben says a good portion of his money will go to Bethel nonprofits like KYUK. Thank you, Ben. And he might try to ride his lucky streak some more by buying some raffle tickets. There's a third winner of the big event. William Savo in Dillingham won Minute Madness. Michelle DeWitt also gave him a call.
I sold you Minute 51. And it turns out, William, that Team Savo has won the $10,000 Minute Madness jackpot this year.
Heck yeah, that's awesome.
This was Savo's first year buying an Ice Classic ticket for the Kuskokwim after buying Nenana Ice Classic tickets for years. His winnings will go towards a vehicle for him and his wife. Everyone else who bought a ticket this year and didn't win can know they help support youth programs throughout the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and that for everyone, spring is beginning. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Mitch Borden in Kodiak, Renee Gross in Homer, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day-over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. The Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders, network with Alaska Native Corporation executives, and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.